So I'm like the child in the well-worn joke of the 3 or the 5-year-old who hasn't yet spoken. And when he comes forward to say his first words, he says, "Mom, would you please pass me that orange juice? And a little bit of water. I'm thirsty." And the parents are shocked and amazed. You know, not only has the child not spoken for so long, but it comes out in full sentences, and they finally get around to asking the child, "What took you so long?" He says, "Well, I didn't have anything to say until now." I'm not saying it's a good joke. I wasn't asking you to laugh at that. I just thought it was a good metaphor for what's happened to me in 6+ years. Many times people have said, "Why don't you speak on politics more?" And I have various reasons. I don't think it's the rabbi's purview. He or she does not know any more about the election or any more about politics than most of you who are well-read, some of you who are political scientists, some of you who have lived in Washington, D.C., or had more experience of the political world than I, although I've done my fair share of work beyond my rabbinate. My expertise is in spiritual issues. And it was not until a few months ago, middle of August, not long after I'd come back from my summer break, that I was able to crystallize in my mind what the spiritual problem of this election, and frankly, as I reflect on it, recent years had been. I came back in the middle of August. I love to read The Economist, which is a British newspaper. It doesn't just treat on economics. It was started to militate against the corn laws in the 19th century in Britain, and thus probably its name, but it is a wonderfully, deliciously written journal. And my favorite section is called Lexington, which deals with United States politics. And not long ago, like I said, roughly 2 months ago, August 20th, there was a wonderful article called Normalizing Narcissism, which effectively describes, I think very powerfully, the spiritual issue that underlies our political age and the corruption of our political age. The traits which in certain measure are extremely powerful, extremely wonderful, make America distinct, unique. Jeff, very unique. Didn't see Jeff Becker. A special country, a beacon. What de Tocqueville loved about democracy in America, the sense of frontiership, the sense of rugged individualism, can be perverted if taken too far. They can lead into dark corners and blind alleys, to narcissism, to quote The Economist, to attention-seeking, to self-centeredness, a sense of entitlement, an exaggerated self-appraisal, warped relations to others, the sense that I did it all myself. I don't have any debt to others. I am grandiose. I am special. I am deserving of my political position. And I'm not beholden to parochial conceptions of the truth. Narcissism is a problem of our age. You see it, I saw someone on Twitter. This may not mean something to all of you, but to some of you will recognize this, who had 20,000 tweets and 500-some-odd followers, which meant that on a regular basis each day, this person was broadcasting everything he or she did within a few on 20-minute segments to a few hundred people, which is to say, no one cares. And that sense of entitlement, that sense of self-centeredness, that sense of bombast, has certainly infected our political process, but also our society at large, rendering us, frankly, infantile. That's what I have to speak on. I can't tell you how to vote. I can't tell you how political systems work any more than I studied when I was in college, a few seminars. But I can tell you that narcissism can erode the very foundation of our democracy. And that's a Jewish problem. The Rabbi Lawrence Kushner, father of some friends of mine when I was in youth group, who became a great writer on spiritual issues, said, Is it not the great childhood problem, and therefore a great human problem, to learn that it is good for you when other people love other people besides you, that I have a stake in their love, that I get more when others give to others? That this is an interconnected, a mosaic community, that our nation is not just about one person and his or her self-aggrandizement, that the success of democracy transcends one or two winners or losers, but involves us all in a common enterprise. And we are called continually these days, it seems, to listen to voices that more and more resemble our own. There are filtering systems on Google and Facebook that ensure that the news feed you see, if you subscribe to Breitbart, you're going to hear more from Breitbart and One America News and Fox News, and if you subscribe to the Huffington Post, you're going to hear more from MSNBC and similar sources. That we're not assailed with differing opinions, and if we are, they seem strange and abstract, and we even contest their truthfulness. We live in these isolated worlds. Ourself becomes our greatest source of value. And my mentor, Bradley Artson, said, this is the spiritual issue. If you ever find yourself summoned to be small or stingy, know that this voice is not God's. And try not to let it distract you. I can't endorse or deny any candidate. I could speak on opinions, I could speak on policies, but we do see these traits represented in various candidates whom we know. In a person, you know, narcissism, I would say, is the internal process, the sense of entitlement, the sense of oneself as the focus of the universe, the item around which the world revolves. And it's modeled in public, it's shown in public through what we might call arrogance, pushiness, decisiveness, over-aggressiveness. I'll give you a few examples. But our tradition was very clear, is very clear that arrogance has no place in a sacred system. Deuteronomy describes Torah and says, it's not in heaven, to which our sages say, that means you can't find it among the high and the haughty and the arrogant. They were clear that one who understands oneself as a narcissist and defines oneself in public as arrogant is hard to place amid the holy and the pure and the heights of the sacred. That image comes in our Egyptian narrative. The Nile River, unlike Palestinian and Israelite agriculture, was a floodplain. That the Egyptians planted their crops in the flood zone of the Nile River, and when it overflowed, their soils were enriched by the largesse of the river. And Ezekiel, one of our great prophets, says, the true sin of arrogance is to think you made the Nile River. The phrase is li yaor, the Nile is mine, I made it. We live in a world that predated us. We live in a richness of a political system that is growing and evolving, stretching and developing and evolving, that de Tocqueville knew, that John Locke inspired. It transcends one man or one woman or the needs of the moment, but was enshrined in the document of the Constitution and the rule of law which we know and love. And we should be wary lest it be usurped by any one person. To continue on a description of arrogance, because I think it's sometimes a concept, at least for me, that's hard to grasp, that's hard to pin down. You know it when you see it, as the Supreme Court justices said of pornography, but it's hard to name. Luckily, we do have a text that gives you some sense of it. The Avot de Rabbi Natan, which was a collection of commentaries on Pirkei Avot, on the wisdom of our sages, on that Mishnah, said that there are seven things that characterize a boor, B-O-O-R, a person whom one might experience as arrogant. and seven converse things that would characterize a wise person. A wise man doesn't speak before one who is greater than him or her in wisdom or age. He or she does not interrupt a fellow's words, doesn't hasten to answer. Their questions are on the subject, and their answers are to the point. They respond with first things first and last things last. Concerning what one does not know or did not hear, he or she says, "I didn't hear." He concedes to the truth. With the boor, the arrogant, the reverse is true. I don't have to let you pause for too long to think about someone you may know or experience as arrogant. We all have those peoples, those symbols in our life. Percy Bysshe Shelley, there was a bit of a contest for this poem, if I recall the history of it, described this in the poem Ozymandias, which is about the poet being regaled by a traveler of a great statuary in midst of a desert. The statue was of a great and former king of an ancient epoch. And at the base of the statue it said, "My name is Ozymandias, king of kings. Look on my work, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." That's the wreck of narcissism, arrogance, entitlement, bullying behavior. The nation of Ozymandias, whatever it was, and this is a fantastical idea that Shelley had, that Rabbi Natan had, was ruled by a boor, and it could not persist. We have in our tradition the most famous experience we know in Torah of the arrogant was, of course, Korach, whom we see in the book of Numbers leading revolt against Moses' sovereignty and against Moses' leadership. And he asserts to Moses that Moses has taken perquisites for him that rightly belong to all. To which one of the latter writers on the subject said that Korach was considered by the rabbis to be a demagogue wrapped in the cloak of a Democrat. Korach was arrogant. He didn't have an eye, say our sages, to see his own smallness. And in the Midrash, they describe how Korach grasped and took for power undeservingly. This he, as I noted in the diagnosis of arrogance, asserted himself as the sole arbiter of value, that he understood himself to be the prime mover of the political system, our first demagogue. It's interesting. We use that word a lot. It gets thrown around so much, so it might be helpful to have a definition, a reliable definition to play with. So the Oxford Dictionaries online describe a demagogue as a political leader who seeks support by appealing to popular desires and prejudices rather than by using rational arguments. In the ancient world of Greece and Rome, he was a leader or orator who would espouse the cause of the common people, a populist. Like Korach, wrapping himself or herself in the cloak of democracy, wrapping himself or herself in the cloak of the common man, in the mantle of the needs of the moment. But like Korach, a demagogue really just seeks his or her own self-aggrandizement. We live in a perilous age. My mother and I joked a few years ago that we could see the twilight years of American democracy. I really fear that we might be in the era approaching the end of the vibrancy of American democracy. Whether it was caused by the issues that are laid out for you in that article from The Economist that I printed, some of you took on your way in, whether it's caused by Facebook and Twitter and the bivouacking, the siloing of ideas, so that we no longer have contact with people who are different to us, who share different opinions, whether it's caused by the ivory tower becoming a place denuded of intellectual ferment. I don't know, but I fear. Because as I've indicated on Rosh Hashanah, the rule of law, the vibrancy of our Constitution, the strength of our democracy is what makes this land great. Yes, we have flaws. Yes, we have things we need to work on. But the richness of American democracy, and as I said then, for that matter, the richness of Israeli democracy, means that we have a chance to be better. And it's fearful when you look at, I don't know if any of you have seen the diagrams that describe voting patterns in the Senate and how there used to be a lot of cross-pollination across party lines, and now they are so far apart, so polarized. What is the future of democracy when that's the state? Korach, we're told, was a demagogue who made sport of Moses and Aaron under the guise of being a Democrat, under the guise of being a supporter of the common person. He mocked Moses and Aaron. He created logical arguments to torture the leaders of the time. He insulted and debased them, say our sages. We have experience, too, of Balak, also from the book of Numbers, who was the Moabite king, whom we're told by Chaim Soloveitchik, one of our rabbis of the 19th century in Belarus, he rose to power by instilling in people the fear of the Israelites. That using the fear of the other brought him to power, brought him strength, because man, fear is a great aggregator. And there were others like Pharaoh, who claimed divinity, who in their narcissism and arrogance rose to power without a sense of their duty and debt to others. So what do we do in the era of a fragile democracy? In the era where narcissism seems to be the spiritual disease of the day, where political leaders seem to have less and less touch with us, with their opponents. In 96, Dole said to Clinton, or was asked of Clinton, how do you feel about your enemy? And Dole said, he's not my enemy, he's my opponent. And civic discourse in the past 20 years seems to have deteriorated precipitously since then. How can we revive that? Not just by voting, although we must and we should. And if you want to speak to me personally, I'm happy to share with you my personal voting preferences, but not as your rabbi. That's not my job. It's easy, it's so easy to be a strong liberal, a strong Democrat, an extremist as a progressive. It's so easy to be an extremist Republican, a staunch conservative, someone who only watches Fox News or only reads the Huffington Post. But it's a dangerous mistake. Conservative Judaism is a very hard place to live as a rabbi, as a Jew, as a person. It's very hard to hold to the center, to believe Jewishly, for example, that just because Torah might not be divine writ, that we should still observe Shabbat, that we should still consider what we eat and what we say as having holy potential, that we should still study sacred writ, even if we don't necessarily believe that God gave it to Moses at Sinai. It's hard to be in the middle. But one of the insights of conservative Judaism, and the reason I love it more and more as I grow, is that it's there to cultivate passionate moderates. Those are hard words to say together. It's very easy to be a passionate communist or a passionate nativist, a passionate authoritarian or a passionate libertarian. But it's very hard, I think The Economist does this well and why I love it, to be a passionate pragmatist, to be passionate about what works in government, to be passionate about finding compromises, to be passionate about listening to people you disagree with, to be passionate about struggling to find solutions for climate change, struggling to find solutions for overcrowded prisons, struggling to find solutions for racial animosities without creating easy answers or slogans. It's so easy to be an extremist. But I think conservative Judaism, and maybe Judaism in general, invites us to be passionate moderates. In the era of narcissists and the arrogant and the demagogue, how do we see through the falsehoods they peddle? There's this hysterical, to a rabbi, I don't know if you'll find it funny. There's a hysterical haftarah that describes the work of an idol maker. And the prophet Isaiah says that the idol maker never looks at the idol and says, this thing is BS, this thing is garbage. He doesn't look at it and say, this thing in my hand is a fraud. But we need to. We need to poke holes in the talking heads and the pundits and the people who peddle easy answers and facile solutions and hatred of the other and blaming of banks, blaming of the wealthy, who deny climate change because it would impede economic growth. We need to poke holes in those orthodoxies that are based not so much on truth and reality and necessity and pragmatism, but based on someone's own narcissistic self-aggrandizement. I mentioned Balak as one of our tradition's demagogues, one of the people whom we saw rise to power through the capacity of instilling fear and working towards people's populist and baser instincts. And in that parasha, Parashat Balak, somewhere in the middle of the book of Numbers, we have the prophet Balaam, a non-Israelite prophet, whom Balak hires to curse the Israelites. And again, he calls Balaam, curse the Israelites so that your curse will be effective when we go to war and I shall win. And Balaam again and again says, I can only do what God puts in my mouth to do. And towards the end, Balaam says, my eyes are open. I am prostrate, but my eyes are uncovered, unveiled. My sight is true and whole. That's a passionate moderate. That's someone who reads The Economist, The Financial Times, The Huffington Post, One America News, watches Fox and MSNBC. That's someone who struggles with the panoply of information and political positions and doesn't sit with an easy answer, but never gives up on the search for the right solution, the right truth, the deeper meaning. That's the struggle I pose for you today. That when you go to the voting booth in some weeks, when you watch the last of the presidential debates and consider your local candidates and your statewide elections, and when you read in the next year and 5 and 10, God willing, we will still be a democracy then, don't look for easy answers. Don't vote out of hatred or passion, but vote with clear eyes, a full heart, and desire to seek long-term success for our nation. Shana Tova.